I'm glad you hopped on that. Mr. Morrow, happy to hear from you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Richard Maurer, and I represent the appellant, Roger Day. Roger Day was convicted in the Eastern District of Virginia, right here in Richmond, of various offenses involving wire fraud, money laundering, and smuggling gold. Last December, Roger was sentenced to 105 years in federal prison for those offenses.
Did you try the case?
I did not, Your Honor. I was brought in on the appeal. Your Honor, Mr. Day's conviction should be reversed, most noticeably because of a constructive amendment which took place at trial. The constructive amendment that was implemented through a jury instruction on aiding and abetting, which was not pleaded in the indictment or mentioned at any point during trial.
Covered by our Ashley case.
I would disagree, Your Honor.
No, it says aiding and abetting is not a separate offense. I mean, that's just covered by a circuit precedent.
Your Honor, I disagree because in Ashley, the court said, quote, that the indictment also cited 18 U.S.C. Section 2, which provides generally for aiding and abetting liability. The indictment in this case, Your Honor, did not allege aiding and abetting liability. And this court...
The question was raised there whether putting an aiding and abetting count, and I mean, charging an aiding and abetting was a constructive amendment of the indictment. The court said no.
Your Honor, my reading of Ashley and my
analysis... What do you say we have to... The prosecutor has to put alleged Section 2 and allege specifically aided and abetted within the confines in the language of the indictment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or it's defective?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's
well,
done...
that's not the law. That's not the law anywhere, I don't think.
Your Honor, that's done routinely by the government.
It is covered here. And we can't, as a panel, even if for example, if I agreed with you, we couldn't, this panel can't overrule an earlier panel.
I mean, you
know, the charge of a defense, you can get an aiding and abetting instruction on it. The government can.
Your Honor, an additional reason why aiding and abetting was a structural error in this case is that it violated the extradition order. The treaty between Mexico and the United States contains, at Article 17, a specialty provision.
But in the Ashley case, we said it, you know, and here it is. We say aiding and abetting need not be charged in an indictment. And then we say again, and this is consistent, it was a unanimous panel, it was consistent with the long line of circuit law, is that this court has, quote, consistently held that one may be convicted of aiding and abetting under an indictment which charges only the principal offense.
Your Honor, I would contend that that case is not on all fours with our situation here, because there aiding and abetting was pleaded in the indictment, and it was not here despite four chances by the government to get it into the indictment. This surfaced at a charge conference where Judge Gibney expressed open disbelief that the government would proceed in this matter. He said, aiding and abetting, what are you talking about? Roger is a principal or he's nothing, isn't he?
Yeah. I would suggest you move on.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'd like to move on to that specialty argument, that Article 17 of the treaty between Mexico and the United States contains this specialty provision which says that Mexico needs to be presented with the charges for which extradition is sought, it needs to consider them, and it needs to rule on what it's going to allow in its sole purview. And, Your Honors, this would not have been an empty exercise in this case. Mexico considered the fourth superseding indictment, and it disallowed extradition on two groups of charges, aggravated identity theft and obstruction of justice.
It all goes down, you know, the rule of specialty is all keyed to an offense. And as we just went over with the last, in our last discussion, aiding and abetting is not a separate offense. And if it's not a separate offense, it doesn't violate any kind of rule of specialty.
Your Honor, my response would be that Mexico needed to make that decision, not the U.S. Attorney's Office. Well, Mexico did.
But the United States and Mexico, that the particular treaty is also keyed on the offense.
It is, Your Honor. And I, again, Mexico needs to decide if this aiding and abetting theory where a principal can suddenly become, I'm sorry, where an accessory can suddenly become a principal is recognized by Mexican law. That's the dual criminality requirement.
The point of the rule of specialty is not to have not to extradite a person on a certain number of crimes and then have a trial on unrelated kind of crimes. In other words, you don't extradite somebody on, let's say, drug smuggling charges and then all of a sudden find themselves under an indictment for previous acts of securities fraud. And that's, you know, that's sort of, so foreign governments would know, you know, when they extradite someone, what they're facing. And the classic case is a security fraud prosecution for somebody who's extradited for drug smuggling. And but where you try someone on aiding and abetting, that is highly related to the underlying offense, and it's known under American law to be not a separate offense. And if we took your view, we'd be really severely cramped in the trials that we could have of extradited people. We'd be under a severe restriction. Wouldn't have any relationship to the rule of specialty or the particular treaty at all.
I don't think so, respectfully, Your Honor. I'm not arguing that the government was foreclosed by specialty from presenting bad acts evidence, by presenting those sorts of things. And, Your Honor, I agree that the archetypal case is where a totally different type of charge surfaces further down the road.
That's what it's aimed at. You and I both know that's what the rule of specialty is aimed at.
But it's not restricted to that, Your Honor, and I would submit to the court the Gallo-Chamorro case cited in our reply brief. In that case, the U.S. government went to the Republic of Colombia and said, look, among the charges that we want extradition on is aiding and abetting. Colombia took a look at that and said, our law doesn't recognize aiding and abetting. We're not going to extradite on this charge. In the same way, Your Honor, Mexico had the right to look at aiding and abetting and assess it for dual criminality. Was it a crime? Was it analogous to a crime under Mexican law? The government, as far as I can tell, Your Honor, thought that aggravated identity theft was a slam dunk. It didn't get it from Mexico. Right. Obstruction of justice based on an officer at the Cancun Airport.
But we can't indict for violations of Mexican law. I mean, we have to indict for violations of American law.
But,
and so, you know, in aiding and abetting has a place under American law, which is very closely tied to the underlying offense. And in fact, it's part of the underlying offense because it just isn't treated as a separate offense.
I would end on this point, Your Honor, with the very simple thing that it was Mexico's job and responsibility to decide if their law recognized an aiding and abetting theory. This surfaced at the 11th hour at a charging conference where Judge Gibney said, what are you talking about?
Well, did he reject the aiding and abetting charge? No, he charged aiding and abetting.
He did, because, Your Honor, just like in this court's leading case on constructive amendment, U.S. v. Floresca, there was no objection. But in Floresca, that was no impediment to this court finding that there was a constructive amendment and that prejudice is presumed. The court also did a plain error analysis, but broadening the bases of prosecution, that's what the focus is on. Broadening the bases beyond the indictment violates the Fifth Amendment.
We said in our circuit precedent that this doesn't do. It doesn't broaden the basis of the indictment. I mean, in the Ashley case drew on a long line of other cases from both ours and other jurisdictions, and we said it doesn't. I really honestly think there are a whole lot of different doors that are closed on these two arguments.
Now, I would just end on these two arguments with, if this case did not involve extradition, did not involve 3 years of extradition litigation in Mexico, where the Mexican government declined extradition on two major offenses, this would be a different case.
We know the facts of the case, and so do you have some other argument that you want to make?
I do, Your Honor.
All right, I would suggest you do it then.
Thank you. The next thing I'd like to talk about is statutory and proof problems with the government's case involving transportation money laundering. Transportation money laundering, Your Honors, requires proof that the defendant intended that the transportation conceal five different things in whole or in part. The source of the monetary instrument or funds, the nature, and finally the location, control, and ownership. And this argument is straightforward, Your Honors. Gold was transported across the border to Roger Day. And to borrow a term from property law, this was open and notorious. Once they got through the border, where they concealed it from the border guards, this gold was handed over to Roger Day in a parking lot. It was loaded into vehicles and brought to his house. The fundamental problem here, Your Honors, is that the concealment isn't from the transportation. The concealment that the government focuses on is from conversion. Conversion of funds obtained from DLA into gold. But the statute is focused on transportation, the intent to conceal those five things I mentioned through transportation, not concealing it through changing money into gold through the services of a gold dealer. Looking at those last three things, ownership, control, possession, there was no question that bringing the gold today confirmed his control over
it. Does it matter under your theory of the law that the money was converted into gold in an effort to conceal?
It does matter because, Your Honor, I would contend that's not something that's reached by transportation money laundering. That may be reached by different types of money laundering.
But then why does it matter?
Because, Ms.
George, I thought you would say it doesn't matter.
I apologize, Your Honor.
No, I'm just asking. Does the fact that he changed dollars into gold in an effort to conceal, does that play any part in the offense, in your opinion?
That is immaterial to whether he committed transportation money laundering because the conversion had nothing to do with transportation. The conversion may be implicated by a different money laundering statute, but that's not one that was alleged and attempted to be proven at trial. In the same money laundering...
What would he have to do under your theory in transportation to violate the statute? How would he violate the statute? How would one violate the statute?
Your Honor, the cases that find transportation money laundering supported is you take the funds or monetary instrument in secret across the border, and then you further secret them. You bury them in the Sonora Desert. You further disperse them so that they can't be tracked down. In contrast, Your Honor, the gold went directly to Day's doorstep, and the government knew enough about it to file the first indictment in this case while Day was still in Mexico.
But this gold is going all over the place. It's going from, starts out in Arizona, and then it goes to New Jersey, and then the gold goes to Houston, and then it goes to Lodomarcos, and then it goes from there to Juarez, and then it heads up to Albuquerque, and it goes to Washington, and then it goes to Vancouver. I'm surprised it wasn't, in all over Asia and Europe and Africa, the way this gold, I've never seen gold, it's flying all over the place. It's transported all over the place. And how could we say, in light of that evidence, as to this gold's rather convoluted and circuitous route, that it was, of course it was transported for the purpose of concealing funds. That's why it was on the move. The gold was on the lam.
Well, Your Honor, the case law points out that there's a difference between money on the move and moving money with intent to conceal it.
What other reason would there be? What was it? It was moved, I don't think it was certain what was moved electronically. The bars were moved, weren't they? The bars themselves moved. What other reason would there be than concealment to have it moved to all these different cities? That's the very definition of what money laundering is all about.
Well, Your Honor,
the jury, it's a jury question in the final analysis, isn't it? Whether we can't, in light of the fact that this goal is traveling all over the heck of a place, we can't take that away from the jury, can we?
Your Honor, it is a sufficiency of the evidence argument. I would just close by observing that this is international transportation money laundering. So the movement which should concern the court is that from the United States to Mexico or back.
Well, it's in three different countries. I mean, it's beginning to quack like a duck and walk like a duck, the duck being money laundering. And the question of what purpose the gold was being transported for would be a classic issue for the trier of fact, wouldn't it? That's what we have those triers of fact for, huh?
I agree, Your Honor, but I would say primarily when you look at the record, the government's case is not about the intent to conceal through transporting. It's intent to conceal by switching back and forth from gold to funds.
Well, both. I mean, the concealment consisted of both prongs. It consisted of the medium in which the investment was made. The gold itself was thought to be less traceable than a securities instrument or a check or some other liquid investment fund. So the fact that it was in gold bars was for purposes of concealment. And then there's another layer to it. The transportation of the gold bars was for purposes of concealment. He was doing it on two levels, and gold, in the jury's view, served his purposes for both. Both as to the kind of fund, investment fund he wanted, and also in the movement of the commodity. It's classic money laundering. You say it's not a fund, but my goodness, do we really believe Congress set up this statute against money laundering and meant to exempt as a fund something like gold, which would be one of the cleverest or one of the means of money laundering that had a relatively greater chance of success?
Well, Your Honor, the court's comments have led to the second issue on money laundering, which is the legal issue.
Would you mind addressing it on rebuttal?
Not at all. Okay. If I have more time at this point, and I apologize for not keeping.
All right, no.
The light's in front of you there. You don't have any more time.
I apologize.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd just like to start by addressing a couple of factual issues that came up during Mr. Moore's argument, and then I'm happy to answer any questions the Court has on the remaining issues. Two things that I think are worth looking at. One, on the constructive amendment and extradition points, I think, Judge Wilkinson, you're absolutely right. As you wrote in Ashley, it's not a separate crime, and I think you're also right on the rule of specialty. That's talking about the offenses. I think one thing worth looking at, though, just in terms of some of Mr. Moore's arguments, is that the Mexican authorities did look at wire fraud, which includes causing a wire to be transmitted, and that language was discussed and adopted in the extradition order. So it's not as if they didn't consider what aiding and abetting covers. They did. It's the exact same thing as causing it to be transmitted under wire fraud. The second point I'd raise is on the money laundering, the concealment purpose. And just to make sure we're correct on the record here, the gold wasn't handed over in the parking lot. If you look at...
It wasn't what?
The gold was not handed over in the parking lot when they got across the border. What actually happened, if you look at 1049 to 1051 in the joint appendix, is they drove it through the desert down to Mexico, got a saw, sawed it out of the bumper after sunset, took it into the house and put it in a lockbox. And so, it wasn't sort of out in the open, but I think the more important point is, as Your Honor raised, is that this money was moving all over the place. There were fake names involved. There perhaps isn't a better case for the type of proof that the Supreme Court was talking about in Cuellar that the government should be adducing to show concealment money laundering. And so I think on both of those points, I think the record is pretty clear. And I guess then all I would say, Your Honors, is that You know, I don't think it's really necessary for us to spend a whole lot of time today on the various evidentiary challenges. I don't think the district court abused its discretion there. And on the sentencing challenges, I think those are pretty clear given the standards of review. I imagine the court may have some questions about Southern Union.
You know, I realize it doesn't have any direct bearing on the discrete legal issues involved, but it's all very, very sad that somebody, in order to make a profit, would have our troops go into the field with substandard parts that were far below the quality called for in the contracts and put the lives of those men and women at risk by knowingly providing the military with parts, substandard parts that were going to be used by American soldiers in combat. And I can't resist. It doesn't bear on the discrete issues, and I understand that, but I'm not surprised given what happened here and given the theory under which the case was charged that the jury returned the verdict that it did.
It did, and Your Honor, I think Judge Gibney, who obviously sat through the trial and read all the pleadings, perhaps put it best when he said the circumstances of the offense were, quote, absolutely vile. And I think there's no better way to put it. It was the second time this defendant had done it.
So I'm just saying, you know, this sentence that Judge Gibney gave, you know, Judge Gibney doesn't have anything to do with the rule of severance thing or the definition of what's a fund and everything. Those are separate. But it sure does have something to do with the justness of the sentence. And Judge Gibney expressed it very well.
Exactly. And to the extent that the appellant has raised substantive reasonableness here and whether or not Judge Gibney considered the various things, Judge Gibney did a very thorough job of going through and saying, I consider all these different things.
Talk to me about gold as a monetary instrument or as a fund.
Yes, Your Honor. There's two reasons why the court should affirm on that. And the first, and I think easiest and most obvious, is that the South African Krugerrands here count as coins of another country and would thus qualify as a monetary instrument under the money laundering statute.
You think so? I don't think that's... it worries me if that's your strongest argument. Do you think Krugerrand as coin of a country is a stronger argument than gold as a fund?
I think that... there's certainly some ways in which each argument is stronger. It sort of depends on, I think, what you're looking at. I think that the funds argument is the most practically appealing. I think that the monetary instrument one, though, is the one that's at least...
So I had the exact same reaction that my colleague Judge Shiv had. I don't know why you were emphasizing the monetary instrument part of this. It's written in the disjunctive. It can be either a monetary instrument or it can be a fund. I mean, but maybe it was you, I don't know, somewhere in the briefs pointed out the gold wasn't being used as a dental product.
Correct.
Wasn't being used to, you know, fill anybody's teeth.
Right.
It's being used as an investment fund in a form that you have an investment fund that was difficult to trace and locate and had unquestionable values. Of stocks and bonds in metallic form.
Right. And I think, Your Honor, the fund argument is clear here. I didn't mean to say, Judge Shedd, that they're not both arguments that we think
you
should
said,
win.
I think you said that the Krugerrand argument was the stronger argument. Maybe I... And that's what you led with, so that makes me believe. Did I misunderstand what you said or did?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. What I am saying...
You want to revisit that and explain to us why gold... as a fund is sufficient.
Yes, gold is.
I think there are questions about what is the currency of South Africa? Isn't it the rand?
It is the rand, Your Honor.
Well, that sort of cuts against you. And does a Krugerrand have a set value?
It does not have a face value. It has a set weight, which is a 1 ounce weight.
I think we can all take judicial notice of the fact that Judge Shedd has climbed and conquered Mount Kilimanjaro. So he knows what he's talking about.
I don't know if that's true or not. I know. I don't know if it has some value. It cost me a great many Krugerrands to do that. but at any rate, I just think this. Let me just make the point. Not being light.
Right.
I don't think that's a strong argument at all for the government. because I think they have various points at which it can be attacked, and it concerns me, really, if you think that's your strongest argument, because I have concerns about it, I would prefer you focus on trying to convince me about gold as a fund.
Absolutely, and I think, Your Honor, that gold as a fund is clear in this case, because what he was trying to do, if you look at the
test... You claim it's both.
Yes.
You claim you could satisfy both prongs, but if you satisfy either one of them, you're all right.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so gold as a fund, I think the best testimony to look at here is when Greg Stewart, one of the co-conspirators, testified. The exchange with the government counsel on direct examination was that Roger Day, the defendant, told him that it was a good way to move money without it being traced.
It depends on what it's used for, isn't it? I mean, this is a sort of an investment asset. Now,
right.
If it were used to make a ring, it would be, if it was used to fill teeth, it would be something else. If it was used to make a ring, it would be another. If it was used in various forms of jewelry, wouldn't that be a lot closer case?
Yes.
But it wasn't melted down, was it? I mean,
no.
It wasn't melted down for any other use. It was kept for its monetary and investment value.
Absolutely.
And a jury was entitled to see it that way.
They were certainly entitled to see it, and in fact, the defense saw it that way. That was part of the defense argument on the lack of concealment in this case, was this was just an investment fund. This is just how he was trying to use his money. And so I think the jury not only could have found it, but the parties were both essentially arguing that same thing on some level in terms of it being for the purpose of investment. And so I think here that when you look at the ordinary meaning of the word fund, it would apply to movement of gold. And this court doesn't need to add on some sort of limitation that, quite frankly, we're not even sure what it would be, how we would be able to limit that statute.
Tell me what your best argument is on the venue point. I've got a question or two about that.
Yes, yes.
Flying the planes over the Eastern District of Virginia.
Yes. The clearest, and I hope I don't get myself in trouble here.
When they fly from Newark to Cancun, go over Norfolk or Richmond, and you say there's vineyard here, right?
Yes, there are. I wouldn't necessarily say that is the strongest of our three venue arguments. We have three venue arguments here. The strongest one is the phone call evidence, and that is the evidence that one of the co-conspirators, when negotiating the prices of gold with the gold dealer here, was in Crewe, Virginia, within the Eastern District of Virginia, making phone calls with the gold dealer, and that's part of the gold smuggling and money laundering conspiracies. And so that's physical presence in here by a co-conspirator negotiating prices of gold. I think that's the first point.
A little bit stronger than the flyover?
I guess I would prefer to say fly
through.
We
don't have to decide the flyover issue. Is that what you're telling me?
You don't have to, because there's sufficient evidence. There's sufficient evidence on the phone call. There's also emails that come within the
district. You've got some cases that support the flyover argument. I agree with that.
Yes, absolutely. And in unpublished cases, this court has cited to...
But that's not authority.
No.
Right.
No.
So, but other circuits have looked at it a little bit, too.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, not only do you have the phone calls, you have the emails that came into the Eastern District of Virginia that were to continue to obtain the underlying proceeds, and then they used those underlying proceeds to pay for some of the money laundering
that
was going on.
So the emails and the telephone calls, you say, are your best venue claims.
Well, certainly, because they came in here and there was a little bit more substantive interaction within Virginia. But I do think it's important to note that, as this court has said in published authority, it doesn't have to be substantial. And there is case law out there to support the fly-through venue. And I think that it would be sufficient here. But I think when you look at all three of those categories taken together, what you have here is an international conspiracy that touched many different venues. And this court's question isn't necessarily to decide what's the best or the easiest venue for any given charge, but is venue proper here? And the defendant had the ability to seek to transfer venue, do all those sorts of things, and those would be the proper remedy for those concerns rather than saying the venue is
Let me go back to the punishment thing for a minute.
Yes, Your Honor.
this fellow got 1,260 months, and you say that's reasonable.
Yes.
I don't want to ask anything further about that, but on the balance of he also had a big restitution sum, $6.2 million, $3 million fine, and forfeiture.
several million dollars, a lot of gold. What's the impact of that Southern Union case on the restitution, fine, and forfeiture points, which the Supreme Court decision post-sentencing here that said Apprendi applies to a fine?
Right, post-sentencing.
Does that upend your fine?
No, it does not. Taking those one at a time, Your Honor.
Well, you didn't have a jury decided.
No, we didn't. But the standard of review here for that is plain error.
So it's error on violation of Southern Union, but it's not plain?
Our position is that it's neither. It's neither error under Southern Union, nor is it plain error. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that there was an admission, when you look at the record here, by the defendant through his counsel, that there was at least $1.5 million worth of loss. So when you look at the sentencing position in this case and the sentencing argument, what the sentencing counsel was arguing was this shouldn't be more than $7 million in loss, but there should be between $2.5 and $7 million in loss. That was their position at sentencing. And so Southern Union makes clear, and so does Apprendi, that it only applies to things that either the jury's verdict or the defendant's admission.
Now we're talking about the fine here?
The fine,
just the fine.
Just the fine.
Okay.
So the admission of there being at least $2.5 million in loss is enough of an admission to get you to a $5 million fine.
Under our sentencing law, do we normally count an admission by counsel as an admission for purposes of sentencing?
For purposes of Apprendi, yes. An admission by counsel under this course's cases, and I think Bartram, we cite in our brief, as well as Revels, and there's a couple of unpublished cases that give some other factual scenarios. But yes, you have to look at things like defense counsel's statements. And in Bartram, the statement was a statement at sentencing that there was at least 150 grams of the illegal substance. And that was enough to be an Apprendi admission. And so it's not just defense testimony or statement of facts. It can include what counsel says. And here I think it does.
How much was fined here?
$3 million.
$3 million.
So all you would have to have would be $1.5 million of loss or $1.5 million worth of proceeds. And I think that's also important.
So counsel admitted enough to justify this fine.
Exactly. And on the proceeds point, they admitted that there was enough gold, that being $2.2 million. They offered evidence of that during the trial.
So you're talking about now, what, the forfeiture?
No, that would be the fine statute for the money laundering charge would be twice the proceeds. And so there's two different ways to get to an admission here. And I think both of those would mean that the fine it's not even error. And we would certainly say that for those same reasons, when you look at the third and fourth prongs of plain error, that even if it's not an admission, that it wouldn't affect substantial rights or this court shouldn't exercise its discretion because there was no undermining of the proceedings.
Okay. So you walk through the plain error points there, Alano, and you'd say the fine should be left alone.
Yes.
Now, what about the $6.2 million restitution?
Right. So moving next to the restitution, there we would say that he also fails all four of the plain error prongs. First, we would say that it is not error in this case because Southern Union doesn't address restitution. Southern Union only extends to criminal fines and doesn't extend to restitution. And every court to look at it, and this court hasn't ruled on whether Apprendi applies to restitution, which would mean that it couldn't be plain error. But if you just look at whether or not it would be error, what you see is that every court to address this says restitution has no statutory maximum. And Justice Sotomayor in Southern Union said...
Is your point that if it hadn't been recognized, it certainly can't be plain error?
Absolutely, absolutely. But we don't even think it's obviously error.
I thought we had some decisions that said that restitution was not subject to Apprendi.
There are some unpublished decisions that raise that. And
the question is whether Southern Union changed that.
Right. And we don't think it does, particularly when you look at Justice Sotomayor saying that
this doesn't... No, but it wasn't objected to. It wasn't objected to at the time, so it would have to be under a plain error standard.
Right. And
you say, as it was applied then, it may be, although there's a question if it applies prospectively, but it certainly wasn't applied at the time, so that would just rule out plain error, period.
Correct. Correct. And we would say it's not error at all, but it's certainly not plain error. And
I'm not saying you're conceding this error. We don't need to even address that, in my opinion, because it clearly can't be plain error. Isn't that your point?
Yes. And the same argument.
What about the forfeiture?
Absolutely. And, Your Honor, the same argument.
That was what,
$4 or $5 million?
Yes, about $4.4 million, but it was a combination of gold, vehicles, and you'd say
that Southern Union, that doesn't apply to forfeiture at all?
Correct. And certainly, I don't think you can get to plain air there either, to Judge Shedd's point, because when you look at it, there's not only...
Forfeiture punishment? It's not punishment, is it?
There's different reasons for forfeiture. The law isn't totally clear on whether it's punishment or...
The defendant's got property that he shouldn't have.
Right, it's disgorgement is the real... Disgorgement is the real purpose there. Yeah. But I think that, in terms of looking at whether it can be plain air... you have here Fourth Circuit precedent on point saying Apprendi doesn't apply. And then you have Supreme Court precedent.
But all that is prior to Southern Union.
Correct.
Right.
I'm just
trying to walk you through. The Southern Union case came up after your brief.
Yes.
And it deals with the fine.
Correct.
That Apprendi applies to fines.
Correct.
So I just want to get you through that here.
Yes. And as it pertains to the forfeiture, Apprendi would not apply to forfeiture, and this court has ruled that in Alamudi and said that Sixth Amendment Apprendi
right. You think it's still good law?
Yes.
Okay.
Because there's no
statutory maximum under a restitution order and under a forfeiture order, because it depends on the restitution. It depends on what you owe somebody, and it can vary all over the lot. Same thing with forfeiture. Well, depends on what the property is that's to be forfeited. And so they don't set a statutory maximum for that.
Exactly. And that's what Justice Sotomayor said in Southern Union, where if there were a fine statute that had no maximum, it wouldn't be a problem there. The problem there was you had an alternative default maximum of $250,000 in a loss case, or in Southern Union itself, $50,000. And the problem was going above that. And you're absolutely right here, Your Honor, that if there is no maximum, and if the court were to apply Southern Union in that circumstance, then...
I mean, if you have victims who are unlawfully deprived of $20 million, then you might be facing quite a tall restitution action.
Right. And essentially be having, bifurcated criminal trials with civil trials tacked on to the end, in essence. And so... with a reasonable doubt standard. And I don't think that none of the courts to have looked at this have said that. This court hasn't said that. And when you were in the context of a plain air review, I don't think that this is the right case. This is not the right case to either reach that issue or certainly not to give this particular defendant relief on these facts.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Mr. Morrow.
Your Honor, this is the right case to reach the issue of whether Southern Union extends to forfeitures and restitution in addition to fines. Your Honor, on the issue of plain error, this court's decision in United States versus David involved a similar situation. The law changed between the time of verdict and during the appeal. In that case...
You have the Henderson case up before the Supreme Court on that point.
Yes.
But I'm not convinced that... given the Henderson case, we have a question about whether plain error, whether that is looked at the time of the law at trial or the time of the law at the conclusion of direct appeal. And, of course, that's up before the Supreme Court now. But if there's no statutory maximum here, and if Justice Sotomayor was distinguishing between a fine on the one hand and forfeiture and restitution and the other, and you look at all the different circuits, they say, well, Apprendi's concerned with statutory maximum, and for reasons we've discussed, there's no statutory maximum.
Judge, I would point out that the decision in Southern Union gives a specialized definition to that important term, statutory maximum. The court said that it was the maximum sentence a judge may impose solely on the basis of the facts reflected in the jury verdict or admitted by the defendant. Now, when you look at the restitution judgment in excess of $6 million, that went far beyond facts that the jury could have found or those admitted by the defendant. It depended to the tune of almost $2 million on a declaration by a government agent, Gary Yielding, that wasn't into evidence at trial. It surfaced at the sentencing hearing. That was the reason for this massive restitution judgment. And that exceeded the maximum sentence under Southern Union. That's something the jury should have looked at. And, Your Honor, there's no principal difference between forfeiture and fines. The purpose is the same. It's payback to what this defendant was allegedly responsible for depriving the government of. But again, the government at sentencing added transactional costs, added related costs allegedly sustained by the government.
District judges make findings like that all the time, but if there's no statutory maximum, and I don't see it, and our prior opinion, admittedly the unpublished, they didn't see it, and the other circuits don't see it. If there's no statutory maximum involved, or if there's an admitted fact, the district court's perfectly free to find something like that by preponderance of the evidence in the course of making a sentencing calculation. There was no, normally the things we get upset about are not present here. You know, there's no guidelines issue. There's no issue about taking the guidelines as mandatory rather than advisory. There's no statutory maximum here. All the little red flags aren't really present here. What you have is a sentencing finding by a preponderance of the evidence, and that's something you're certainly free to dispute. I suspect it's under a plain error standard. I mean, a clear error standard, but doesn't seem to me it'd be an Apprendi issue or a Southern Union issue. What it seems to me to be a question of is just district court fact-finding.
I would disagree, Your Honor, because the core concern in Southern Union is that the facts that are used to expose a defendant to a sanction which is beyond the statutory maximum be decided by a jury, be accompanied by rights of confrontation. And again, I would just return, statutory maximum in that decision is explained as something which goes beyond facts found by the jury or facts admitted by the defendant. And this declaration of Gary Yielding wasn't considered by the jury, it wasn't admitted by the defendant, and it upped the restitution judgment.
Well,
from
if there's not a statutory maximum, you know, a lot of times sentencing findings can be based on uncharged conduct or acquitted conduct or things that weren't brought before the jury. The question is, is there an Apprendi error or a constitutional error? Otherwise, it's just fact-finding that happens in a sentencing hearing every day, and that subject to clear error review, and the district court is permitted to consider all kinds of things in trying to arrive at a factual determination. I think that's what the other circuits are saying.
That's what they said before Southern Union, Your Honor.
I wouldn't think they would change it.
Well, this is undoubtedly a substantial monetary sanction on all fours with the fine that was reversed in Southern Union, because the jury never considered those facts, and they didn't hear either, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, we will adjourn court and we'll come down and greet counsel.
This honorable court stands adjourned. Sign and die. God save the United States and this honorable court.